So this particular equation is the one we're going to play with quite a bit. It's just one particular example. This one where this velocity of q is just q itself. And this is, again, what we'll, if we do the analysis of what the characteristic speed of this equation is precisely q. So itself is determining how things will propagate. So let's just see what the problem is, or why is it this equation so different from that equation, even though they are very similar, except that here the characteristic speed is determined by the solution itself. And for that, you can just imagine that we have a given solution, q0, say, of x and t, that is a solution to this problem. And we just care to know what happened with perturbations on top of that. So imagine there is another solution, which is given by q plus some delta. And we can linearize that equation with respect to delta. And what we'll see is that the behavior of this delta is simply it's a solution. So, this is so q naught comma t plus q naught comma x is equal to 0. And I'm just linearizing over top of it. So what we want to know is what happened with perturbations on top of that equation. How do they, how do they behave? So now, suppose we have taken initial data here. Q naught x, because that's, I said the RA, so that's part belongs to the lower order terms. Oh. So there is a time, there is a space derivative of Q times delta, but we said, so let me just add that. So if we do everything to first order, then we'd have that. But we said, we argued yesterday and the day before yesterday, yesterday, that these terms are lower order. Our main variable that we're interested in appears undifferentiated, so we can ignore it as far as the characteristics is concerned. And so we just take that out, and we think we see what happens. So suppose that at some region here, this function q is such that so this q naught is given, q of x, and we want to know what happens with delta as time goes up. So we know that locally, we can calculate what Q naught is, that's given, and that we know that the solution, again, ignoring the lower order term, is going to be given by functions that behave like Q0 t minus x at every given point. So suppose now that we have q0 of a point x2 comma t less than q1, q0 of point x1 comma t. Or imagine that x1 is less than x2. So this solution, which is solution to of the equation that we're interested in, just describes an object that is propagating to the right with a velocity q0 that depends on the point we're considering. So if I stay, if I pick points q x1 here and x2 there, there is a characteristic going to the right, emanating from here, another emanating from there. And depending on what the value of the q function is at the point x2 and the point x1, the characteristics will be faster or slower. And because of this assumption, we see that the velocities or the characteristic speed emanating from x2 is smaller than the one emanating from x1. So what you have is, this will be the characteristic that you'll anticipate from x2, and this is the one that you anticipate from x1. And that's a problem. The problem is now, remember what the characteristic notion told us, is that this solution will be constant along the characteristic, and so we could determine the value here by simply tracing back to the point where the characteristics intersect the initial data and just read it from there. But once characteristics cross, and we're here, then it would appear that the solution is multivalued, because if we trace back along these characteristics, or back along these characteristics, we'll have generically two different answers. And that's the problem that these equations have, but these equations do not. Because as things propagate, this profile, the solution itself, doesn't keep the profile. So remember, because the value of the function here was equal or is equal to the value of the function there, we just continuously keep along the same characteristic and the same here from the point emanating of x2. And at that point, they just invariably meet, and we have this multivalued problem. So here, we need to understand what's going on. Certainly, nature doesn't have that problem. Physically, we expect that the solution is valid here and every points afterwards, and so we need to find a way to understand how to deal with this problem. And in order to do that, we're going to have to look at the characteristic problem in particular and try to come up with some method to make sure that we can obtain a solution afterwards. Before I do that, let me just give a simple derivation of just mass conservation, and that's going to be one of the equations that we're going to deal with in the hydrodynamics problem. So let me just... So let me imagine this, and the reason I'm going to introduce this is because we're going to use this picture later on to come up with a way to discretize problems that have that kind of characteristics. So we imagine that this is, say, this space. That's time. And suppose everywhere in space we have a function rho of x and t, which is just the density of, say, some fluid. And we can just write what the mass would be in here at that time, at time t. This is, say, t plus delta t. It will be the mass at time t contained in the cell between x1 and x2. And now we're interested to know how this mass will change as time proceeds. In particular, we want to know how we can estimate what would be the mass at this time, at this new time. Let's imagine that the boundaries of this cell are porous, so fluid can come in and out. And so the change we expect intuitively, the rate of change of mass between this time and that time, has to do with the amount of fluid that went in and out of that cell. And so for that, we know that the time derivative of mass, we have to do with the rate of change. I'm just saying here the rate of change of the mass is the amount of fluid that goes through the boundary x1 minus the amount of fluid that goes through the boundary x2. And the signs of u will tell us where things are coming in or out of that cell. So now the only thing I'm going to do is just iterate this equation in time, between time t and t plus delta t. And this is simply m of t plus delta t minus m of t equal to a And now let me re-express this m back in terms of the integral. So this is just the integral of rho of x of t plus delta t minus rho of x t So here we just have the difference in the masses equal to the integral of the fluxes, the difference of the fluxes on the left and the right. And now the next step is, sorry.
What is the function
u? U is the velocity of the fluid.
Oh.
So now if we assume that all the functions here that we have considered are differentiable, we can re-express this here. Notice that we have rho evaluated at x, which we're integrating, but we have the difference between t plus delta t and t. So this is just the derivative of rho. So I can re-express this on the left-hand side as t1, t2, d dt of rho x, t dt. And here what I have is this evaluated at x1 minus this evaluated at x2. If I imagine that x2 is close to x1 plus small delta, I can re-express as just the derivative of rho times u This is the same as d dt rho dt integrated between t and 1 and t and t plus delta t. And this is the same thing as d rho u with respect to x dx between x1 and x2. So I can now put both things together and then just express this as a double integral of d dt of rho, and here I had a minus sign because I have x1 and I imagine that x1 is more than x2. Which just expresses the continuation or the continuity of this variable rho in a cell. This is the time derivative of the rho has to do with the spatial derivative of the flux of density through the cells. And we would argue then that, well, because this has to be equal to zero, then this is the equation, the continuity equation that we would impose or they would try to use to obtain rho. So I'm going to leave that aside for a second. We're going to come back because that integral or that way of thinking about a cell and things coming in and out and how what goes through the boundaries determines what we have at a later time, given that we had what we had at initial time, that's the picture we're going to go back to when trying to obtain a particular discretizations that will deal with this problem. So how do we deal with this problem now of multivaluedness of our formulation. It's a complicated thing that I actually don't have time, or we don't want to get too much into details. But a way to make sense about this is not to look at the differential form of the equation, but actually to look at the integral form of the equation, similar to what we did here. It says, rather than trying to interpret what is the solution to this equation, you interpret it in the weak sense. By that, we do is we iterate over both space and time, set it to zero, and we weight that equation with respect to another variable, phi, over a function, which is a known function, which is arbitrary. Also arbitrary. And this technique is referred to as trying to obtain a solution in the weak sense. We're not looking for satisfying the differential form, but satisfying it through an integral differential equation with a weighting function phi that is arbitrary. We just require it to be smooth. And if we can find the solutions for all phi's that you can think of this equation, then the function q that you find is the solution. If you use iteration by parts, you can see that this equation is through iteration by parts. It's equivalent to the following. So this is where we use this function phi that we threw in. If you use iteration by parts, you can re-express this equation in this way. We'll notice now q does not appear differentiated anymore. And the only things we're differentiating is phi. And this is equal to, or this equation is equal to this, where it has a right-hand side that only knows about initial conditions for both phi and q. So going through this is a way to get solutions to this problem that will go around having these issues that we discussed. The problem that you have in doing so is that you generically find more solutions, more than one solution to this problem, even though you were trying to find solutions to this. The solution is not generically unique. Other conditions need to be imposed on the behavior of the function q so that you single out a unique solution. This typically, in order to single out a unique solution, the other ingredient here is, apart from the weak solution, so you look for weak solutions, plus something that is known as entropy conditions. Which ensure that whenever you have a solution past this point, through this approach, if you have more than one solution, you impose that the solution that you find afterward has to have more entropy than what you had before. That condition typically singles out a unique solution. And these are things that we're going to build into the approach we take to iterate these equations, and you'll see how we go around doing so. Let me just put that aside. I mean, we can talk a lot more about this, but I don't want to spend a lot of time because typically you're not going to think about this problem. I just wanted to make you aware that these issues are there and as a motivation for the kind of things that we're going to try to do now. Let me now go back to this problem that we had. And then try to find a solution to that. Before that, let me complete and give you the full solution of this problem. For the very simple case of something that is known as the Riemann problem. Which is a problem where you take your initial data to be such that Q of x at t equals 0 is equal to some value, which we're going to define as QL. And as we do so, we're actually introducing a little bit of notation that we'll use afterwards. QL and QR, where QL is for, say, x less than 0, and QR is x greater than or equal to 0. The solutions to this problem are given by, actually, two conditions. So one, if QL is greater than QR, the solution is given by the following. QL, if x is less than QL times t, QR, if x is greater than QR times t, s times t. So let's backtrack a little bit. This case is the case where the value of Q at the left side of the real line is greater than that of the value at the right side. As a result, what you have is a situation that looks like this. So this is QL, this is QR, this is x equals 0. So you know by our previous discussions that things here will propagate in that direction with velocity QL. Things here will propagate in that direction with velocity QR. But this one catches up to that one. So it begins to push on the value that we have at QR. And that generates this continuity with this, that we had it initially to begin with, to be more and more marked. And there is a line that emanates from here, right, where this characteristics cross. And this line is a shock, which propagates at speed s. And you can check that this speed s is just given by QL plus QR divided by 2. So I'll leave that as an exercise. You can obtain what the velocity of this line is, which is QL, the velocity of that line that is QR, and by just solving for the trajectory where these points meet, you can find out that the slope of this curve is given by QL plus QR divided by 2. We're going to have a simpler way of determining this later on that we'll use in the particular methods that we'll employ, but this just make sure that you derive this, just to convince yourself where it's coming from. No, but it captures a lot of the problems that we're going to have to deal with in hydrodynamics. And by building a method for this one, is the one we'll use for the hydrodynamics. Just as like last week, when Matt showed you a method to iterate the simple advection equation where you had u dot equals constant times u comma x, and then you use those techniques to treat the scatter field interacting with a black hole background, you're using... You never change the derivative operators. You use exactly the same ones. The techniques that you use were motivated by the simpler equation. So we're doing exactly the same thing here.
So it's going to be like a modified version of this?
It will be a hugely modified, yeah.
These are baby steps, and then you're going to have to take real steps.
But you'll see how all the things that we discuss here do come into play in the general problem, which we should cover, should begin studying tomorrow. But before that, I need to give you this basic infrastructure. Yes? No, we're not going to try to avoid the shock. The shock is a consequence of the equations that we're solving. They are invariably there, and even if we give perfectly smooth initial data, they will generically develop these shocks and discontinuity just because of this darn thing that we discussed. The characteristic speeds that depend on the solution to itself. Well, so in fluid dynamics, the equation, the Euler equations or the hydrodynamic equations we have, is just a representation of the Navier-Stokes equations. Those have shocks. Nature doesn't really have shocks. What nature has is abrupt discontinuities or abrupt changes in the gradients in a very, very narrow region, which will represent as shocks. Right, right. Yes. Well, you're standing on one, in some sense. Right? I mean, there is a huge discontinuity on the density of the floor and the density of the air surrounding it. So that is an example of something that is stationary. It's not changing in time. But that's one of the things you have. In the surface of a star, you have density that is very, very huge and vacuum outside. And this thing can oscillate back and forth. And you're going to have to deal with the consequence of that. The gravitational field, on the other hand, is perfectly fine. I mean, you don't feel the difference in the gravitational field. But that's because the nature of the two equations are extremely different, as we discussed. Yeah, in one case, the hydrodynamic equations have this, the general relativity equations don't have that. Matt, you had a comment?
This is going to point out, you don't hear it so much anymore. But when I was a kid, airplanes used to go supersonic all the time. And then you flip the end of the towel, that snap. That's a shock wave, and it's very well modeled as a discontinuity.
No,
it's
out of representation.
Well, I mean, the thing is, if you believe the mathematics, then the only honest thing you can do is represent it as a discontinuity. But that's what these techniques are about. They're called fancy methods, but they're called shock capturing.
Right.
They pay attention to the fact that they're shocks.
And you'll see how we build that in, because a lot of assumptions like continuity or smoothness of the solution, we're not going to be able to use. We're going to have to prefer our methods to realize that something like this is going on and adapt itself. And that's what Matt was referring to, this resolution shock capturing methods, because you're going to have to realize where it is and do something about it. Dave?
So if I just look at this equation and I imagine that I have a discontinuous solution. So now the Q is going to be a step function, and the Qx is going to be a delta function. And now I'm multiplying a step function by a delta function, which is something that, the usual, sort of thing that people tell you about distributions is something that you're supposed to, either not do or you're really nervous about doing or something like that. So is there some way of seeing why this is still all okay?
Well, we're going to deal with that by adjusting at the numerical level. At the numerical level, we're going to adjust the type of derivative operators that you use. If you have such a discontinuity, you're actually going to skew things one way or another, and you're going to add some information about how this shock is going to propagate. And so all these things we're going to have to build in, otherwise the scheme will typically not work. And you guys will see that in your homework, you're going to be able to actually solve the problem with techniques that are stable, and it will work. But if you compare, you're going to actually put this particular problem, and if you compare how that shock is propagating, even when things are even pretty decent looking, you're going to get a completely wrong speed of propagation. And of course, if now a shock propagates at the wrong speed, you're going to get the wrong physics. So this was for that case. This case, if you solve for the weak solution, this is the only solution that you get. But you could have the opposite situation where QL is less than QR. So now, again, we have the step function, but on the opposite direction. This one is propagating that way fast. This one is propagating that way, but not as fast. So what you happen, if you see, now imagine, say, this point. Now I have arbitrary close to that point. My solution is propagating away that way. My solution here propagates away, but at that speed. So I open up a funnel here where it's very tricky to find out what the real solution is going to be. If you do it through this weak solution approach, then you find out that the solution, Q of x and t, is given by the following. QL of x less than QL times t, x divided by t, QL less than t, less than QL times t, less than x, less than Q right times t, and Q right, Q right times t less than x. Yes.
Where did we introduce an asymmetry between the left and the right that we should get a...
In our initial layer. In our initial layer, we constructed...
But how is that different from condition one?
Because here we were assuming that the q left, so imagine left was everything in the negative side of the real.
Right, but I mean symmetric.
No, it's not symmetric. They're both positives. Imagine that zero.
It's the advection equation, not the wave equation.
Right, there's only one time derivative, right? So there is, you don't have both modes. It can only exist only one mode. So this is a solution. This is a true solution. If you actually go through the weak solution procedure, you're also going to have this one as a solution. But this one doesn't satisfy this entropy condition. So the real solution is this one. And again, in your homework, you have a particular problem where you're actually going to have to look at this equation, this part of the solution being satisfied. So now let me pause a little bit. So here we're pretty much going in a kind of haphazard way, disorganized way. I've tried to show you some of the problems that one encounters with these equations, this possibility of things being multivalued, which you have to deal with, these propagation speeds that are pretty much determined, that are determined by the equation and the state of the function at given points. And again, as I was saying before, if you try to do this problem through just standard or the basic numerical techniques, what you'll typically find is, well, in the worst case scenario, things will just blow up. I mean, it's just things don't work. If they don't blow up, you might end up with things that are this very steep gradient. You're going to end up inducing wild oscillations or very, very bad oscillations near the discontinuity. You're going to be smearing down the discontinuity as time goes by. And even if over all those things you can control somehow, you might have the shock propagating at the wrong speed. So we need to react to that and come up with particular schemes that will deal with this problem. And the reason I introduced this Riemann problem is that we're going to exploit this heavily in the particular scheme that we're going to use. So, and in order to do so, we're going to go back to what we did here. Because here, there was one step where we assumed something that we know we can no longer do. If we're dealing with this kind of equations. Remember, we started with something considering some iterations over a cell, and at some point we say, well, if we equate the integrals and we have to have a zero at the end, therefore the integrand has to be zero, and we just say that was the equation we can solve. Well, in doing so, we had to assume that these steps were true, that the difference between of rho, let's say, at times t plus delta t and t can be approximated by the time derivative. That assumes that this function is differentiable. But we now know that it's not necessarily the case. So what we're going to do is introduce first the formal study. So suppose we have this equation. And just to make it slightly more general, we're going to assume that we have this equation instead, where we're saying, we have the time derivative of q has a term that has a derivative, but we're going to consider it as a more general. So in the case of Berger's equations, this happened to be q squared. But let's imagine that it's a generical one. And we might have a source. This source will be another way to either add or subtract energy or density or whatever we're thinking about in physical terms within this cell. But now, knowing that we cannot assume that the function is differentiable, what we're going to concentrate is thinking that there is a cell. We're going to try to represent this in a different way. So we're going to consider that this equation can be understood by saying this is the integral. We're going to iterate it in time, in space. So what we're doing here is saying, rather than considering this equation, let's consider an integral form of that equation. We're actually saying, instead of the qt, we consider the integral of qt over dx. We're considering because we have this cell again, this x1, x2, t, t plus delta t. We're going to consider the integral of q here, and we want to know how it's going to change to the new level, and that's given by the integral of this and the integral of that. And we have to throw in the 1 over the volume, which of course we can simplify, but this is just so that we're saying we're considering the average, the change, the rate of change of the average of q in the cell x1, x2. So we're integrated over x1, x2 and divided by the volume of that cell. No, x1, x2.
Okay.
And now, if we do it in time, we also integrate in time here. Well, let's say this is t2. And let me define the following quantities. So I take q, I iterate it between x1 and x2, divide by the volume, but I iterate that. So I'm going to assign this to be the average value of q in this cell, which if I have it between x1 and x2, I'm going to define that it lives at the center of the cell. That's why I'm putting 1 plus a half, which is perhaps hard to read. Let me just do it again. Let me define also the quantity f to be 1 over the volume. So, sorry, 1 over delta t. So t1 and t2 of f. So I want to remember what this f was. This was the stuff that would go through the surface, through the boundaries of the cell. So I just want to define, just as I define an average notion of what is inside, say, the cell at any given time, I'm also going to define an average notion of how much flux might enter through the boundaries. So I define it to be f as 1 over delta t, the amount of time I have going from one point to the other one, of t1. Times t2 of f evaluated at the right boundaries. So this is either x1 or x2. So let me just call it. Because I'm integrated between t1 and t2, I'm going to label it with the time t1 plus a half, or t1. Yes, Chris.
So just to clarify, V is the space volume, not space time?
No, V is the space volume.
Okay, so we already simplified out the delta T.
Or I'm going to actually add it in the next step, but at the end of the day, we can simplify them all, but at least at the formal level, we can define it this way. We're going to put all those terms together.
The other is that with XI, we're now considering multiple
one or two
cells next.
Yes. Well, I saw that we can do it at R equal 1 and 2. But now what I'm going to do is, after I consider the 1 and 2, let me just do I and I plus 1. And now these are generic cells. They're generic boundaries of the cell. And, of course, this midpoint is sitting at x I plus a half, and this, now let me imagine this is Tn, and this is Tn plus delta T. This midpoint is Tn plus delta T divided by 2. So with those definitions, let me now just tell you what we will have here. So here I have Q comma T, which I can express as in the following way, q hat n plus 1 minus q hat or q bar n divided by delta t plus f n plus 1 half and I plus a half. I plus 1. It's also phi hat . So what I have in here is, remember, again, physically what we discussed before, the rate of change of the average of Q at time n plus 1, or the change of the average of Q at n plus 1 in between cells xi and xi plus 1, minus what it had at time t, is given by the amount it crossed of flux that cross through the left boundary minus the one that crosses through the right boundary divided by delta x.
I think we want an extra n plus a half there.
Yes, sorry. Thank you. And so we could formally use this rule, which again is in the average sense, to update what q bar n plus 1 would be. If we know q bar n, and of course dt and dx, but there's a problem here. The problem is that, notice that these fluxes, which is what traverses the amount of flux that goes through the boundaries, these fluxes were defined as the integral of whatever source, of whatever flux function we had, through the whole boundary, all the way from t1 to t2, or tn and tn plus delta t, which is tn plus 1. So in order to use this expression to obtain qn plus 1, unfortunately, we need to know q, which is what we don't know. So you could think of doing it iteratively, similar like to what the Crank-Nicholson method that Matt described last week and that you have been using. Just put a guess and keep iterating till you converge. But that typically will be slow for these kind of problems. And also there are other ways, there are other methods that would get the job done in without as much computational cost. And these are techniques referred to as Godunov methods. So we're going to use for this. And the reason... Because I'm defining this to be at the I plus a half. The nodes have exactly this offset by a half, so I was going to fix that. I'm going to let them know. But at the moment, everything is fine. So the flux is at the I and the I plus a half. So I have this equation.
No,
so
the
If my center is at I plus half.
Why isn't it I plus 1 minus I at all?
I plus 1. Which one?
There's a sign error, right? It should be I.
Oh, sorry, sorry. This I plus 1 minus I. Yeah, sorry about that. No, I thought you were looking at the notes. So in the notes, I ended up putting the left boundary xi minus half and this I xi plus half, and the center was at xi, but everything is the same as up to 1 half. So notice what we're doing here is, suppose we had a function, and let's for simplicity consider it smooth. We have our cell. Let me imagine that this, these are the points of our space grid. What we're saying is take that cell, compute the average that the function have there, and assign that value to that cell. So if I take, say, the average of this, it might be some value that's this way. Say that's the average that this function will have in between these 2 points. Now I go to the next 2 points. The average of these two will have a function, will have a value that might be here. The next one, it might be kind of zero. The next one is something like that, and so on. So what we're doing is we're choosing a representation of our function based on average values in between the cells. And as a result, what we have in between points is a discontinuity. Notice that the value of the function we have here is positive, and we assign it as our approximation to what Q is doing at this cell. At the next cell, we have this huge discontinuity between this point and that point, between this cell and that cell. From that point of view, what we have done is turn our problem into essentially something that is a Riemann problem. So we have our equation to deal with, our fluxes, and what we have here is some number or some constant value next to it, another constant value. That's the reason we introduce a Riemann problem. The Riemann problem is because what we're gonna use is to use explicitly our knowledge of the Riemann problem solution to obtain a solution to this problem, or to obtain a method to deal with this problem. For that, we're gonna have to, however, reach some compromise. Still, our fluxes depend on the solution itself. That's the problem we just mentioned. So what we're gonna do, and what all these techniques do to these high resolution shock capture methods, is to come out with essentially something that provides a recipe to how to evaluate these fluxes, given that you don't want to iterate forever. You want to know the status of the function at a given point and be at a given stage and be able to update to a new state. So these Godot of methods will solve Riemann problems through using, will use an approximation to the fluxes, and it will do something else to make sure that if there is a discontinuity, we react to it appropriately. So let me just give you a recipe for that, and we're going to discuss the different ingredients before we run out of time. So when you, if you ever go seriously to try to do some work on hydrodynamic equations, we're going to present one particular method for you. That's not the only one. There are many, many of them. And they all, of these high-resolution shock capture methods, are based in Godot of methods, and they give you different techniques or different approaches to evaluate these fluxes. And so they all have some particular name. The one we're going to use is something called the row solver, which is actually a pretty involved solver that uses a lot of the information of the equation that we are dealing with. There are other ones that are cheaper solvers that don't require as much knowledge of the full structure of the system, but at the same time, they don't give us an accurate solution for the same computational cost. So we're going to introduce this one, and this is the one you'd use in your problems. So let's go back to this equation. I'm just keeping with the notation of the notes. Let's change the piece. So the first thing we're going to do is, if we have a source, we're going to ignore it for a moment. Once we have the source, because it's a lower order term, we can always add it a posteriori. So we assume that the right-hand side is zero. We have this. Yes?
We had a spatial derivative there?
Yes, here. is what I was going to write. Yep.
Oh, and we also had a Q.
No, the Q was for Berger's equation.
Right, I thought that's what you said you were going back
to. No, sorry. No, we're going back to the, at least the formal generic equation.
Oh, I see.
And the reason I want to do that is because Berger's equations have a very simple structure, and we want to discuss a little bit more in general these problems. The Berger's equation had Q equal Q squared. The other thing I'm going to assume now is that Q may not be a single variable, but we might have a vector of variables. So again, we're slowly working our way to the hydrodynamic system, where Q will be the density, the velocity of the fluid, and maybe the pressure. So Q might be, Q can be a vector. Of functions. So the first step we're going to do here is we need to know, we're going to use explicitly the characteristic structure of the problem. For that, we need to know how to read it. The problem that we have here is we don't clearly see how to write the matrix that will give rise to the characteristic structure. So the first step is to linearize the problem. Notice we're not actually taking the linear approximation to the solution. What we're saying is, suppose we have a solution at a given time, let's linearize with respect to the solution at that given time. So what we write is, approximates dx of q as df of q dq dx, where this df of q will be evaluated at the state of q has at for any given x at time t, if we're going to t plus delta t. So we now assume we know everything up to t. We're trying to give a recipe to advance to t plus delta t. So once we do this, now we can ask what the characteristic structure is, because the matrix in front of our system is defined. So we can define the matrix A be just df dq. And we can ask to the matrix A, because we're assuming that we're using the value at the previous level. Now A is something that's completely known. We can obtain the full characteristic structure of A. So now we need an approximation to these fluxes. So the rho flux is given by the following. Okay, so this is the most important ingredient for this solver, and I have to tell you a bit, I changed notation, so I'm going there. So what I'm doing is the value of the flux that we're going to put here or there, so you just pick a cell here or there, pick a cell boundary. The value of the flux that you're going to have to put in here, it's a combination of three things. First is the value that the flux will have, the flux that you have evaluated here. Evaluated, remember that in our picture, we might have a value of the field here and another value of the field there. So we're going to distinguish left and right values. So that's what this thing is saying. Evaluate the flux by using the knowledge of the function that you're trying to iterate at the right side of that cell and at the left side of that cell. And you still have to tell you what these bit wheels are, but bear with me just a second. And we're going to subtract to it this term, which is the sum over all the eigenvalues that the problem has given that you know the matrix, you have obtained all the eigenvalues, multiply by these omegas, and I'll tell you what these omegas are, and R is the eigenvectors. So you multiply the absolute value of the eigenvalues, the value of the eigenvector, and these omegas are jump conditions. These are the conditions I mentioned are thrown in there explicitly to ensure that the solution we're picking is the right one. If we don't have this one, the problem might be picking up one of these weak solutions, but not necessarily the correct one. This is the one that ensures that the entropy across the shock is always increasing. Now I have to tell you what these P tilde are. These P tilde are the following. And this is one of the last things we're saying. We're trying to do as good a job as we can. So let's just pick that particular cell. We have the right value of Q. And we have the left value of Q. And we're going to, I still haven't told you what P is.
The right value is on the left.
Oh, right. I'm left-handed. And I do it again. That's right. So we have the left and right values. So what we're trying to do is obtain something that will tell us, remember, the value of the flux in here. So what we're going to do first is to approximate, given that we know, we're assuming that this function is a constant here and a constant there. But we can do better. If we know that the value of the function here and its derivative, we can do a better approximation to what the real value of the real function is doing there by a second order approximation. So we're going to try to implement that, but we also don't want to overshoot, because if we have a true discontinuity in the function, we want to just not try to use anything that will assume that the function is smooth enough. Let me show you what we're doing first, and then you'll see where it's coming from. So let me write it in terms of first instead of Q. So Q left twill at I plus 1/2 is equal to the Q bar I plus sigma I Okay, so let's concentrate on this line. What we're saying is the value that the Q will have at the cell will be equal to the value that the Q has at the middle of the cell to the right, plus a little bit. That little bit we have here, the distance between the center of the neighboring cell times, so the distance between the center of the neighboring cell and the boundary, this is xi plus 1/2 minus xi, multiplied by this sigma I, and this sigma I plus 1 will be the derivative, the spatial derivative of Q, if Q is smooth enough. And if not, we're going to react to it. Let me just write what this sigma I plus 1/2 is. Sigma I plus 1 is defined to be, and I'm going to throw in a fancy function here. Okay, so let me explain what we're doing here. We have, this is the cell of interest, We have one cell here, another cell there. This is, say, the center of this cell, let me call it I plus 1/2. Let me just look at this. This is the cell, and this is the first neighbor, and this is the second. So what we're saying is the value of the Q that we're going to use in here is going to be what we have here at the center, plus something that we'll know about the slope, the gradient that Q has here, times the distance, but we're not going to use all slope. We're going to use something that will try to control how much we're going to cope with as far as difference in slopes are concerned. So we're going to use this thing called the mean mod slope, which is a slope limiter. So this is just simply saying, tell me what is the slope, the gradient of the function here, the gradient of the functions there, and let's compare them. The mean mod is a function, mean mod of two numbers is something that will be zero if A times B is less than zero. That means if we have a slope here that goes like this and another slope here that goes like that, the gradient, we just are detecting that there is a discontinuity, so we're not going to use anything. We're just going to copy, we're going to assume that the value here is exactly the value there. This is one of these things that we're trying to do if we're beginning to develop a situation that begins to have a behavior like that. Then we're going to try to minimize the bad influence that those things will have, and therefore we're just going to copy the value here into there, and that's what we're going to use in the fluxes. On the other hand, if we're going to use the value A, if on the other hand we have two slopes with the same sign, so something like this, let's say like that, we're going to use the minimal, the smallest of the two slopes. Where at? Oh. So this seems like we're putting a little bit of too much of our hands into the particular implementation. But what it's doing is simply to say, if we're across a shock for one of these discontinuities in general, we're just going to lower our approximation to just first order accuracy. And this is fine because there the function is discontinuous. We cannot get out a lot out of nothing. We're going to say, if we have such a discontinuity, we're just going to keep track of the value of that, so it works if it moves to the left or to the right. We're not going to try to use more information that we can, given that the function is discontinuous. And the fact that we're choosing the smallest slope is still trying, if it is trying to rise a bit too much, we're just, in some sense, reaching a compromise, trying to capture a little bit of the gradient, but not the worst case scenario, which is the one with the largest slope. Again, but this boils down to, once you have the numerical implementation, is that everywhere where the solution is smooth, the approximation is second order, and you're going to get exactly the kind of behavior that you've seen before. As soon as you have a discontinuity, the accuracy will drop to first order, but you're going to keep track of the right shock. But I still haven't, yes? I still haven't answered your question. Your question, all of a sudden, I throw in some P twiddles, and this is something we're going to discuss tomorrow. Anticipate that today. In the equations that we have, we typically will end up having things like, so let me just, going back to the example of rho and u, we might have an equation that says dt rho plus say dx or some flux, which is, let me just write what we had. This is for the continuity of matter. But then we want to have dt rho u plus dx of something else equal to zero. for the velocity. All these techniques we're dealing with are devised for systems that look like this. Let me just write it once again. Q, T plus F of Q, x equal to 0, where you're trying to get in here a single variable derived with respect to time. If you look at what we have here, we don't have such a case. We have dt of rho u. Rho u wants to be its own entity, plus something like that. Of course, we can use the chain rule, and by doing so, enlarge our system. But if we do that, we lose these flux conservation properties that these things have, where the rate of change of a variable is reinterpreted by the amount of flux that goes in and out of a given cell. So it's going to be a lot more convenient if we have such a case to define a new variable, Q to be rho times U. So we're going to iterate another set of variables, which in this case will be rho times U. Once we have rho times U from one of the equations and rho from the other one, we can divide this Q by rho and obtain U. So we're going to have two sets of variables which contain exactly the same information. One will be the conservative variables, those that lend themselves to writing the system in such a simpler way, which might not be the physical convenient ones, and those will be the primitive variables. And so we'll choose one set of variables or another one, depending on what particular step of the iteration we're carrying through. But we're going to finish up this tomorrow and connect with the hydrodynamic equations, so you'll see how, indeed, we're going to have to add a number of variables to keep track of what the state of the system is in terms of variables that are better adapted to this kind of equations. So any questions? So just a reminder, in the web page, there is already a tar file with all the files that you need to download to implement the Burgers equations. Go through the notes. The notes walk you through some exercises for the Burgers equations where you're going to be able to compare. You're going to be able to compare the standard discretizations, some perhaps better motivated discretizations, and in all cases, you're going to see the shortcomings that those discretizations might have for this kind of problem. And then you're going to have, as a fourth option, one that actually implements this row solver. So begin taking a look at those so that you can do the simple examples, and then we're going to be able to begin the real problem number two, which is using these techniques to deal with relativistic hydrodynamics. So everything should be in the web page, and if you need anything, just let us know.